this is The Takeaway. I'm Melissa Harris-Perry. Good to spend part of our day with you, and glad you're with us for part of yours. We begin today with some major news that emerged this week from one of our country's most consequential deliberative bodies. Nah, y'all, I'm not talking about the retirement of Justice Stephen Breyer from the Supreme Court. We're going to get to that next week. You know, when everyone has actually had a moment to digest things and think about the future and analyze a bit. Breathless coverage, y'all going to have to miss me with that. But no, I am referring to Cooperstown. The National Baseball Hall of Fame. As the kids say, we're talking baseball.
I'm talking baseball.
I'm trying to reach David Ortiz, please.
This is David Ortiz.
I'm calling you from Cooperstown, New York, to let you know baseball writers have elected you to the National Baseball Hall of Fame.
Yes! And arriving at their individual decisions, the electors took into consideration the following voting criteria: the player's record, playing ability, integrity, sportsmanship, character, contributions to the team or teams for which the player played.
Slugger David Ortiz was voted into the Hall this week, while pitcher Roger Clemens and all-time home run king Barry Bonds did not make the cut. Now, as a reminder for some of our non-sports or non-baseball people, or maybe even just younger folks, since it's now been a whole generation, Clemens and Bonds are statistically, arguably, the best players at their positions. It's worth noting because Clemens and Bonds missed for the 10th straight year, and that means they will no longer be on the main voting ballot going forward. The Baseball Writers Association votes on the Hall, and the reason Clemens and Bonds have been not voted in is their association with the steroid scandal of the 1990s and aughts. They were the biggest faces that were part of it. But it's a little weird that the writers were okay with Big Papi Ortiz getting in because he failed a steroid test in his career as well.
What did we learn, Palmer?
I don't know, sir.
And this news got us thinking about some of the other important news going on right now in the sports world, which is, of course, also a business world and a world of culture. So, from the baseball diamond to the football field, we're talking about players, coaches, and halftime entertainment. That's right.
Let's get it crunk up on that fun up on up in this dancery. We got y'all open.
Mary J. Blige, Dr. Dre, Eminem, Kendrick Lamar, and Snoop Dogg will be on stage during the Super Bowl in what's sure to be a fantastic performance. So fantastic, in fact, that we're completely distracted from the controversies off the field. Like the fact that in a sport where over half of the players are black, there's only one black head coach in the entire league. So yeah, SCOTUS can wait. We're talking sports. And with us is Amira Rose Davis, Assistant Professor of History and African American Studies and co-host of the podcast Burn It All Down. Welcome to The Takeaway, Amira.
Yeah, always great to be here.
All right, let's start with the NFL. And Brian Flores recently let go as head coach of the Miami Dolphins. There is now only one black head coach in the league. What is going on? And did somebody like trash the Rooney Rule? What's happening?
Yeah, I mean, it's the annual mess. Mike Tomlin is the only black head coach in the league. I think the reason why these particular firings on what's usually called Black Monday really caught everybody's eye because it's right in the annual discussion of the Rooney Rule really not really doing anything and the huge disproportionate number of black players. And then you have one black coach. It's ridiculous, especially when you have somebody like Brian Flores, who, you know, Dolphins weren't great, but he also led the team to consecutive, you know, winning seasons for the first time since 2003, which is when I was a high school freshman. So, I mean, it's not like he was doing nothing there. But the other firing that really caught headlines was, of course, Coach Culley down in Houston, Texas, because it was his first year playing with, you know, QB controversy and not a lot kind of happening there. Still won, you know, four games, which is probably more than we expected. And he was let go after 1 year, which is fairly rare. And also they were like, yeah, we have a different philosophy, which is something I don't know that I feel like you should figure out when you interviewed the person a year ago, especially when they now are rumored again to be considering Josh McCown, who has no head coaching experience at any level, but was of course their former quarterback. And so it just feels like we're stuck on this broken record loop that, hey, maybe we should have black representation in coaching staff. And everybody being like, yeah, totally. And it never happened.
Wait a minute. I'm still recovering from you being in high school in 2003. But okay. Really, I was like, wait, what? Okay, so let's dig in one more step here, because I feel like there are few groups of people for whom it is harder to gin up sympathy than NFL players and NFL coaches. This is a very highly remunerated field, and unless you're really talking about the injuries or the head injuries, which I think all of us have a very human relationship to, I can imagine there are some folks like, what difference does it make? These are professionals being paid a lot of money to play a sport. If your coach is white, pull yourself together and go play anyway. So why should we care whether or not there's a black head coach?
Yeah, I mean, I think we should care about power regardless of where it manifests. I think that what we see is people getting stuck in the pipeline. And I think there, if you take an interest, for instance, in Josh McCown, who's never coached at all, after firing a head coach who waited 27 years in the assistant ranks to get that opportunity, we're talking literally just about discrimination. We're talking about these ideas of what makes a good coach, right? Why is there this thought, this untested, you know, person with high football IQ and all these like code words that we use to talk about like industrious white quarterbacks like Josh McCown. Why is that the criteria that front offices feel more comfortable with? Now, some of this we like know the answer to. Even when you set up the question, you're like, yes, we know who's assumed to have knowledge and who's assumed to be strategic thinkers. And I think that what we see across multiple sports is that Black coaches have less second chances, right? And usually what that means is that a lot of people, don't get the chance. And when they do, as we've seen this year, it gets taken away quite fast. And I think that frustration, when you see coaches like Eric Bieniemy, of course, from Kansas City, like who... The coordinators, I mean, if you watch the games in the past few weeks, the coordinators who are giving us these really great play calls and defensive schemes, et cetera, are often not finding any purchase at these upper ranks of head coaching. And I think that that is concerning because it tells the players and it tells the audience that Black bodies are good for one particular thing, and that's to gladiate themselves. But please don't think that you can, you know, lead a team.
All right, why don't you take me on out to the ball game now? You do not have to buy me peanuts or Cracker Jacks, but let's talk about Barry Bonds, Roger Clemens, and the Hall of Fame rules. Can you help us to understand the rule change and its history, and how is it that Barry and Roger struck out?
Yeah, you heard in the criteria that sportsmanship, character, et cetera line, which is really what everybody trips over. And so for the last decade, there has been this battle annually about how you evaluate that character component of these Hall of Fame votes. So it's been a decade. And what this signals is essentially that those who have a vote have decided to just like shut out folks from the steroid era, despite the fact that it was widespread, despite the fact that some people is based on insinuation, never a test. It feels kind of arbitrary, especially as you mentioned, you know, Big Poppy. Now I'm a Red Sox fan, so like I, you know, whatever.
You're like, but whatever. Come on,
but,
Big Poppy.
These are facts. These are things, right? But I also think that, you know, it is about the hysteria of that era and our continued, you know, way that we apply these kind of doctrines of fairness. And I feel like we do it quite unevenly. So, for instance, we've started to see that character debate also encompass other folks on the ballot, for their politics, but rarely for like harm, right? Rarely for, we don't talk about accusations with Bond in terms of like his abuse of his wife, allegedly, right? We don't talk about that. It's all about, you know, did you cheat? And so I think that even this idea of like, oh, this character conversation is the big one. Well, it's a particular part of the character conversation, right? This idea of like, what do we think fairness looks like in our sport? And as you mentioned, it was an era where they were already pacing in front of people because they were just good. And so I think I'm of the mind personally where I'm just kind of like, okay, if they're still hitting the bar farther than everybody else who was also on steroids, and, you know, I think they're, you know, pretty good at baseball. Maybe they should be in the Hall of Fame. But I think that the controversy over it every year really gets to the heart of like these kind of myths that we tell ourselves about what fairness or ethics look like in sport. And it's really not a black and white issue, despite the fact that the voters of the Baseball Hall try to make it one.
Okay, let's zoom out a little bit and talk about a more global sporting event that's upcoming, the Olympics. I just want to, I know, I'm sorry.
I'm still recovering from the summer games. I can't believe the winter ones are here.
If there is one weird, like, time folding on top of time thing that I just can't quite get my head around, it is the Winter Olympics coming months after the Summer Olympics. I keep feeling like maybe I missed a year or two of my life somewhere. Shouldn't there have been some time in between? But because although there was some time, there hasn't been a lot, COVID is still the story. Yeah. Can you talk to us about what's happening there?
Well, a mess. So COVID is still a thing, yes. We just saw the first positive test for a bobsledder on Team USA. It's absolutely still a thing as we have yet another mega event. And COVID in many ways is constraining, certainly, you know, participation in terms of athletes who might test positive, also in spectators, but it's also kind of taking a backseat to a lot of the political concerns coming out of Beijing as we head into the Winter Games. And so it's interesting because the Winter Olympics generally are fighting for attention compared to the Summer Games. The run-up to the Summer Games have a lot of human interest stories. We already know and love these athletes we get packages on. And the Winter Games usually are kind of fighting to fly above the radar. And it's interesting as we move into these games, the dominant stories are not about the sports, are not about the athletes. They're really about the politics and the pandemic. And it's an interesting position to be kind of moving into, where it's like this huge cloud hanging over the games, both in terms of public health concerns as well as political ones.
I want to take one beat on the diplomatic boycotts, yeah, and whether or not they're impactful or make a difference.
Yeah, well, I don't think they make a difference in the eyes of the, you know, Olympic officials. I think that it's also a way for people to politically, you know, it's essentially like a warning. It's like a, you know, if you ever got a yellow card in school, like, It doesn't have much of an impact.
I was maybe not the best sportsman on my soccer team. Sometimes my big mouth got me into trouble.
Exactly. But you know, like, honestly, if it's not backed by like any other kind of action, it's just that, it's a piece of paper. And I think that there's, you know, some real there, whether we're talking about human rights violations in China, or also, you know, what is emerging as a concern is the way that athletes' voices are being policed. Now, we had this conversation during the Summer Games, particularly around the IOC's continuing enforcement of Rule 50, but also the way they were trying to like say, okay, you can protest, but like only a little bit, et cetera. And now, you know, Chinese officials have warned foreign athletes to make sure that they are not running afoul of Chinese law about speech, which is drawn more restrictively than the IOC, which is saying something because the IOC is still very restrictive. And I think that is something to keep an eye on in terms of how athletes' voices are actually kind of in danger here. And not to mention, of course, the China's record on human rights violation, which is promoting or prompting a lot of these international boycotts. But ultimately, how does any of this amount to anything when the Olympic Games are, you know, when the IOC has still decided that it's fine for Beijing to host the games, right? Like, when we're already at the process of a mega sporting event, despite concerns that have been raised since it was awarded, then all of this kind of feels like gestures that are just kind of like exactly that. They're gestures that will be made and the games will roll on as they do. And everybody will try not to get COVID. And, you know, it's like the Summer Games all over again. It will just come and go. And it's kind of frustrating to be at this point because there's all these different points in the lead up where there could have been different decisions. Or if people actually cared about human rights, maybe they wouldn't have been awarded the Olympics in the first place.
As we're signing off here and you're talking about and name checking here the question of athletes' voices, I do want to just point out to the whole Takeaway listening family that Amira has a new gymnastics podcast series. It is dropping on February 21st on Apple's New and Notable. And she got some voices for real, interviewing Black gymnasts from the 1980s on up forward. And got a lot of folks saying things they'd never said before. We can't wait here at the Takeaway for this podcast, and we're excited for you, Amira.
Thank you. I'm so excited for everybody to hear their stories in their voices on their terms. And let me just tell you now, buckle up because
Okay, so I'm listening to that one late at night with a glass of wine. I got you, yes, no problem.
Maybe two glasses are necessary.
Amira Rose Davis is an assistant professor of history and African American studies and co-host of the podcast Burn It All Down. Thanks again, Amira.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, The New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.